Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Frank Cogliano. How are you doing today, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
Doing pretty well. This week, we're going to sort of dispense with our usual two or three topics, and we're going to spend, the entire episode talking about one topic having to do with monuments. Earlier this week, the city of New Orleans removed a controversial monument, and so we wanted to spend an episode talking about how the public commemorates the past, both on the landscape and in celebrations, and in the ways in which we recognize the difficulty of thinking about the past and the present together. So that's going to be the topic we're going to address pretty much for our entire episode.
But we'll have last drops, too.
Oh, to be sure. Worse.
David, I actually want to throw... I think it's appropriate for you to start, since... The monuments in question relate to your particular field of expertise. So the city of New Orleans took down these, began taking down Confederate monuments. I think they took the first one down and there are more to follow. Could you say a little bit, I'd like to hear the kind of background to this and why the monuments are there and what your view of this
is. So there's four monuments in question, one of which has been taken down, three of which they are planning to remove. They haven't announced the exact schedule, but it's presumably in the near future. The three they are planning to remove are a statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, and General Beauregard, who was from Louisiana, so he's, somewhat appropriate that there's a statue of him there. So they're going to remove those in the near future. The one that they removed earlier this week is actually technically not a Civil War memorial, although lots of the news coverage has described it as a Civil War memorial. It's actually a memorial to an event in Reconstruction, an event that the monument itself describes as the Battle of Liberty Place. The event it commemorates sometimes goes by other names. Sometimes it's called the Battle of Canal Street or the Canal Street Riot, and has a few other different terms you'll see in the scholarship to describe this event. Essentially, what it is an event in 1874 in which there was essentially a military coup that pretty much took place in Louisiana. I think many of our listeners know Reconstruction was a very contentious politically, but it was also very contentious militarily, in terms of tremendous amounts of violence. And Louisiana is a state that had a tremendous amount of violence. This monument that got removed commemorates this event in 1874, in which there had just been an election for the governor's office. The Republican candidate, William Pitt Kellogg, is being supported by the federal government because he's a Republican. The Republican is the party of Lincoln, the party of Grant, who is in office. The Democrats claim that their candidate won, and basically what happens at the Battle of Liberty Place is that the White League, which is sort of the paramilitary arm of the Democratic Party, tried to overthrow the Republican government and succeeded in doing so, I think, for two or three days before the Grant administration stepped in and reasserted Republican control. 35 people end up getting killed in this battle, if you can call it that. You might want to think about it as a coup. That's kind of how I think about it. So that's the event that this monument commemorates.
And so it commemorates the 35 people who were killed?
No, it doesn't actually commemorate the 35 people who were killed. It commemorates the brief time in which white Southerners are able to overthrow Republican rule in the South, or Republican rule in Louisiana for those two or three days they're able to have this coup. So it's not to commemorate the 35 people who were killed. It's to commemorate essentially white supremacy. And I think thinking about when this monument actually goes up, it isn't a monument that's put up immediately after the event. It's a monument that's put up in the 1890s, I believe in 1891. And if we think about what's going on in the South in the 1890s, when this monument and when lots of both Confederate monuments and obviously this one is a Reconstruction monument are being erected, this is the time in which white supremacy is really being established in its most bleak form in the South. This is the time in which Jim Crow laws are being enforced. This is the time in which you're having disenfranchisement of African Americans, many of whom had voted, you know, since the Civil War era.
Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896.
But and this is also the time in which you're having a tremendous amount of racial violence in the 1890s. So this is when you have these sort of spectacle lynchings are very much at their height. Some people have called this, you know, the nadir of race relations in the United States in the 1890s, the early decades of the 20th century, you know, in which African Americans were killed in public and whites could enact violence on African Americans without fear of prosecution.
It should be said, sorry, for our listeners, the Plessy versus Ferguson decision legalized separate but equal facilities. So it made Jim Crow...
it's what gets overturned in Brown versus the Board of Education. Right?
60 years later. So the 1890s are a bad decade in terms of race relations.
It's a bad decade for race relations is an understatement. This is a radically profound time. And I think, you know, when we think about monuments... You know, monuments, we often think about them as commemorating events in the past, but they're often about as much about the time that they are erected, and usually they're more about the time that they're erected than about the time they're trying to commemorate.
So does taking them down say more about the time in which they're taking them down?
So, you know, this is a monument which is very explicitly about white supremacy. You know, the event it's to commemorate the Battle of Liberty Place, I think even the name they give it is a... suggestive of the, you know, the fact that it's about sort of creating liberty for white Southerners against what they saw as being the interference of the National Republican Party, which believed in racial integration and a biracial kind of democracy. But when they put the monument up in 1891, it was celebrated as this is a symbol of an event that we want to celebrate as the beginning of sort of the dominance of white supremacy in Louisiana and sort of at the apex of white supremacy in Louisiana in the 1890s. That's when they put the monument up. And it's interesting because, you know, four decades later, they actually add a plaque to the monument in the 1930s.
Yeah, this got a lot of coverage from the news coverage this week.
Yeah, so there's this plaque that's put up in the 1930s that make it explicit about, just in case to remind people if they... You're passing by this monument and didn't know what it meant or what this battle was or why it's important, they make it very explicit that this was a monument to white supremacy. And I'll read the sort of plaque here. McKierney and Penn, those are the Democrats, had been elected governor and lieutenant governor by the white people and were duly installed by this overthrow of carpetbag government, ousting the usurpers, Governor Kellogg, parentheses white, and Lieutenant Governor Anton, colored, also in parentheses. United States troops took over the state government and reinstated the usurpers, but the national election of 1876 recognized white supremacy in the South and gave us our state.
So it actually says white supremacy on the plaque.
And it says gave us our state, right? And so the, you know, who's the our there? And it's white Southerners being given back control of their state over... African Americans. And I think it's, you know, the fact that it explicitly says white supremacy, that's why that monument is there, I think is quite telling.
So David, I mean, this is fascinating stuff. Do you think the city of New Orleans deliberately began with that monument because it's easily the most objectionable of them? Whereas, we'll get to Confederate monuments and memorials in a second, but is this one easier to justify to the public?
Well, this you know, if you're going to start with any monument, this is the one of the ones to start with because it is so explicitly about white supremacy and about racial violence and all that. And it's one that the city of New Orleans has been trying to get rid of for years. I mean, they started, I think, in the 1980s, trying to sort of having conversations about getting rid of it. At one point, it's actually not in its original location. It's actually already been moved once within the sort of same neighborhood. And it's actually been a site that has been championed by modern versions of the Klan. So, like, David Duke has tried to have rallies there, you know, if its meaning wasn't, you know, already apparent. And so I think that's really sort of why they started with this particular monument, because it was so explicitly about white supremacy. Whereas some of the other ones, I think we need to unpack a little bit more about the connection that the monuments have to, you know, the messages they're trying to send.
I mean, P.T. Beauregard, as you say, is a major historic figure in New Orleans and Louisiana.
Yeah.
We may not approve of what he stood for, but it's not beyond the realm of reason to say, you know, having a monument or to a local a significant local figure is not outrageous, right?
Well, I'm also, you know, skeptical that we can sort of, you know, what they're celebrating in the Beauregard statue and the Davis and statue and the Lee statue really is their service for the Confederacy. It's not a sort of broader, you know, when they dedicated these statues, they didn't say, oh, look, here's Beauregard who did this, that, and the other thing and was in the Confederacy. It's very much linked to their service in defense of slavery, fighting for the Confederacy. You know, and it's linked not as explicitly, I think, to white supremacy as obviously the Liberty Place monument is, but it's pretty close.
Okay, all right, but let me play devil's advocate here. And one of the arguments that's made by people who defend these monuments is, I mean, I think there's an argument that historians can make, and I'll make that in a second, but the argument that's frequently made by the public is that the Confederacy, these honor the military sacrifice of the soldiers of the Confederacy who fought for the independence of their country and fought honorably and were defeated.
Yeah.
And that this is, these are war memorials, not unlike the war memorials that the Civil War era memorials that one finds across the North, for example, in many small towns. And so that this is honoring the military legacy of the Confederacy. What's your response to that?
Well, so I think one thing that's interesting about these monuments and the debate that's happening across the country about, you know, preserving monuments or taking down monuments or relocating monuments or contextualizing monuments is how much of these conversations are local. Because I think the specific local story matters. And I think there's something that's meaningfully different about, you know, a statue to soldiers that's put up on a battlefield, for instance, versus a statue of a military leader that's put on a place of prominence in a city. You know, when we think about Confederate monuments that are erected, a lot of these are erected in the, you know, 1890s, in the first decade or so or two of the 20th century, really at the sort of height of white supremacy, in which, you know, that is being sort of, and they're using the Confederate memory as a way of reinscribing that. And they're often putting these monuments, you know, in places of power and significance in cities. And so, you know, if you're putting your Confederate statue right in front of this town courthouse, and you're an African American going into the courthouse and you have to pass by a Confederate soldier in order to do it, you know, that's not accidental. I think the symbolism there is pretty clear. I think that's a different, it's sending a different message than if you take that same statue and you put it on a battlefield, or the same statue and you put it in a graveyard. So I think we need to contextualize, you know, these individual monuments, what the stories between, you know, why it was erected in this particular place and time. What did it mean to the people who were erecting the statue? What kind of message were they trying to leave for the future? Right? Because I think in some ways when you're, you know, people are placing a monument, they're talking about the past, but they're actually trying to influence the future. You know, they're trying to say, this is our version of the past that we want our future generations to remember. So I think, you know, in as much as the past is trying to control the future, we should be very cognizant of what kind of ideologies embedded within it when it's dedicated.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from, and I largely agree with you. How do you feel about, I mean, I think there was a widespread expression of support for the removal of this white supremacy monument earlier in the week, at least on social media in certain areas. There was a backlash, and you can talk about that. But how do you personally feel, both as an historian and an American, and as a citizen, about the removal of that monument and monuments generally?
I think it's really complicated. I don't like having the past control us in the same way that I think that monuments, when you put them in the public square, have. You know, so I think we need to sort of there's gradations of, things like the Confederate flag. I think there's one category of ways you need to think about things like that. Because obviously with flags, you need to sort of put the flag up every day and take the flag down every day. It has to actually be preserved and re-inscribed. Monuments are one thing. Buildings are something else entirely. I think these things should more often than not go in a museum. I think that's where often they belong. I think, taking them down doesn't mean necessarily you have to take and scrap them. I think, putting the Battle of Liberty Place monument, in a museum, I think might be in a more appropriate locale for. I mean, this you've come up with this a great deal when you think about, sites attached to Jefferson, and Jefferson's memory's obviously been much more contested recently because people have paid more attention to Jefferson not only as a statesman but as a slaveholder. How has that come up in the discussions people have had around Monticello and other sites associated with Jefferson?
As you say, it comes up all the time. In fact, as many of our listeners will know, Monticello was on the outskirts of Charlottesville, Virginia, which was Jefferson's hometown. And in Charlottesville itself, as I know you know, there's a dispute over Confederate monuments. And indeed, when you were talking about the Courthouse Square, I was thinking about that because there's a Confederate monument in the Courthouse Square in Charlottesville, which I believe is being taken down. There's certainly been a debate about that. And that did prompt some defenders of that statue to point at Monticello, which is on the outskirts of town, and say, hold on a second, if we're, as it's often portrayed, if we're expunging slavery from history, which we're not, what are you going to do about a place like Monticello? I think, and I will say, I know the folks at Monticello quite well, and this is something they've grappled with for a very, very long time, in fits and starts, but especially in the past 20 years, they've really come to grips with Jefferson's relationship with slavery and his legacy, both for him and for the country. I think that one crucial distinction that has to be made is that Monticello, as Jefferson's home, which is a museum, is not a monument to slavery or white supremacy.
Not explicitly.
And one can argue about, well, it was never intended as such. One can argue about Jefferson's legacy and have a discussion about Jefferson's legacy. And indeed, race and slavery and white supremacy are a big part of that discussion. And in very interesting, innovative, and admirable ways, Monticello is leading that discussion about Jefferson, especially with the efforts they've made to restore the plantation aspects of Monticello for the public. But the house itself is not a monument to slavery or white supremacy the way that monument in New Orleans is, which is explicitly, as it says on the plaque, a monument to white supremacy. So I think Monticello is many things. It's a kind of physical manifestation of many of the things Jefferson believed in. But it was a working plantation, and I think presenting it as such leads us to have a discussion about the role of slavery in his life and the role of slavery in the history of the United States. So I think Jefferson's home, for example, and I think this would apply to Mount Vernon and Montpelier, James Madison's home. I think a lot of these historic homes that were owned by and inhabited by the so-called founding fathers of the United States force us to discuss slavery or give us a way into discussing slavery. So I think they serve a very useful function in that way. I don't favor, for example, taking down the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., even though Jefferson owned slaves.
Yeah.
A theme of the Jefferson Memorial is slavery and liberty. Now, actually, the history of the Jefferson Memorial is very interesting because Franklin Roosevelt carefully chose and, in fact, edited the quotes there to make Jefferson appear more anti-slavery than he actually was. But the Jefferson Memorial is a monument to the more admirable aspects of Jefferson's legacy. We're aware of the less admirable aspects, and we have that conversation.
Yeah, well, and in some ways, it's a monument that tells us more about the 1930s than it does about
the 40s, that's right. Well, you're absolutely right. Monuments are about when they were put up. So the Jefferson Memorial is a case in point. It's dedicated in 1943, which is the bicentenary of Jefferson's birth.
Okay.
Of course, the Second World War is raging. Yeah. It's a statement of what the United States was fighting for in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Or And it was FDR's statement about Jefferson mm-hmm. and what America stood for. And so it's a monument to that as much yes. as it's a monument to Jefferson. But in terms of how historic homes should be presented,
yeah.
this is there is probably no historic home anywhere in the southern United States, and arguably in east of the Mississippi River, mm-hmm. that's not in some way implicated by slavery.
No, to be sure. And there's a decent number of historic homes on this side of the Atlantic that aren't implicated by slavery. Yeah,
yeah, and we're going to get to that, indeed. I mean, this is a transatlantic phenomenon. It's an interesting question. Now, we're not going to tear down all the historic homes, and I know you're not suggesting we do so. To some extent, you say put the monuments in a museum. That's a reasonable position. Mm. These homes are museums, and so you have that discussion. Yeah, yeah. So I think we're on reasonably solid ground there. I don't think anybody. I don't think Monticello is the equivalent of a Robert E. Lee statue opposite the courthouse in Charlottesville. I think there is a distinction that one can draw, and I think we need to have these discussions and make those distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question is, I've got two questions for you. There are people who are heavily invested in many of these symbols and these monuments, who are citizens, they're law-abiding citizens, they're taxpayers, they want them to remain. There are equally people who are opposed to them, offended by them, and frankly are living with a legacy of the oppression those monuments represent, and their views need to be respected and heard too. But I'd ask you, how do we reconcile those? The second question I would ask is, and you mentioned landscape earlier, we're historians. You rightly say these monuments tell us they tell us more about the time they were erected than the events they commemorate. But as historians, these are parts of the landscape that we read. Mm. These are themselves historic artifacts. And you're not suggesting this, we wouldn't go into an archive and start expunging objectionable material from documents.
Yeah.
So should we be doing so with physical artifacts that are historic sources
as well? Yeah. So
there's a two-part question there for you, and they're both pretty complicated questions. Okay. So over to you, David.
This is why we only had one topic today. It's like the essay questions we give our students. It's got one question with eight parts to it. If they don't answer one part, we failed them. All right. Students with exam preparation, we're not actually doing that for you. Both Frank and I are usually pretty nice. But anyway, one of the things that strikes me that makes this debate interesting as to reconcile the fact that some people want to keep these monuments, some people don't. I think it's telling that a lot of these decisions are being made very much at the local level, and it's a response to democracy playing itself out, right?
So the fact that New Orleans actually has an African American majority in terms of its citizenry,
I think is important. Yeah, and the fact that it's actually taken so long for them to remove these monuments, I think, is actually telling about how much respect they are giving to the minority of people who want to keep these monuments. It's also telling New Orleans that they had to remove these monuments, like the Battle of Liberty Place monument was removed in the middle of the night, and the people who were removing it were wearing essentially like tactical gear to make sure that, and there were like police sniper stuff going on. So I think they were very concerned that people who were upset about it would respond violently if this monument was removed. So I think that's telling. But I think, basically the democratic process should be at work. Local communities should decide for themselves what monuments, what parts of the past they want to celebrate and what parts they don't. The second part about sort of, changing the built landscape. One thing I think is interesting that makes this story different in the United States than it would be maybe on this side of the Atlantic is there seems to be a notion in the United States that once you put up a monument, you can never, ever take it down. That we should be beholden to the decisions made in the past about what the landscape should look like, and I don't think we have that same sentiment here in the UK, where there are lots of parts here just within a couple blocks of our office, where we could say, oh yeah, there used to be a building there that was very important, and they tore that down 300 years ago, and there's a monument over here that used to be, you know. And so the ephemeralness of the past is, I think, much more recognized in the UK than it is in the US.
In fact, there's a debate, there was a news story last night here on the BBC News, about they're changing the name of a music hall, Colston Hall, in Bristol. Now, they're doing it gradually in 2020, because Edward Colston was a very prominent slave trader based in Bristol, and Bristol was a major entrepot for the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, in the late 17th century. And because of Colston's connections with the slave trade, they're renaming this major music hall where the Beatles played and the Rolling Stones, and it itself is historic
venue,
but they're renaming it because of its association with him. However, there are lots of things locally named after him, because he was a very eminent and wealthy local person, an MP. And so there was a similar debate, and in fact, Jefferson came up in that context, because in the debate on the radio last night, they cited Jefferson as an example why you don't rename things. So it is you're right, it's a transatlantic phenomenon, but the British do seem more willing to rename than perhaps they do in the United States. Or is this a Southern problem? Is this in the American context? The real debate seemed to be about Civil War monuments.
Civil War monuments. Well, Civil War monuments seem to be more... Well, I mean, no one's trying to take down American Revolution monuments. I mean, these are more contentious monuments than any other monuments we've got in America. We don't have, you know...
No, but nobody's suggesting doing anything about... You know, Mount Rushmore is very close to, and was certainly on land taken from indigenous peoples.
The indigenous people are talking about.
Yeah, right. But that's right. And then one has to respect that. But, you know, we've got four massive sculptures of individuals who all in their ways from a native perspective are objectionable.
That's true. Yes.
While some indigenous people might be campaigning for this, it's not the same kind of issue that the debate about Confederate monuments is.
Well, I think it's, you know, the lost cause, this sort of this mythology about the Confederacy that develops in the decades after the war is such a profoundly influential sort of modality that shaped Southern culture over the past 150 years, and it's sort of this romance with the Confederacy, you know, has for generations really, you know, shaped how people think about the Confederacy, think about Southern race relations, and the ways in which the Lost Cause has been used to sort of justify, you know, white supremacy, and it's been used to sort of reinscribe all these sort of really horrible practices, I think is part of the reason why people are so attached to it. And you know, the Lost Cause has been showing up over and over again in sort of the debates over the events in New Orleans, because part of the Lost Cause says the Civil War wasn't about slavery, which is, cover your ears, listeners, if this is offensive. The Civil War was fundamentally about slavery. We know that because the Confederates told us it was about slavery. But the Lost Cause said it wasn't, and some of the defenders of these monuments say that these monuments aren't monuments to white supremacy and slavery, despite the fact that people who put them up say they're about white supremacy. You know, one of the things that thinking about the British Concert Hall buildings, I think, are also a sort of slightly separate category of monuments that we need to consider. Because buildings, I think, are different than, say, statues or you know, obelisks or what have you. In as much as you actually have to interact with a building. You have to go into a building. You engage with buildings in different ways than you deal with monuments and things. And you can always rename buildings in the way you can't rename an obelisk. And you can't say, oh, that was, you know, or a statue. That was, you know, Robert E. Lee, but now we're going to say it's somebody else and change the face on it or something. You know, there was a recent situation at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, go Tar Heels, in which there was a building, Sanders Hall, which was named after the leader of the Klan in North Carolina during Reconstruction. And when they erected the building and named it after him. They were very explicit about naming it after him because he was a defender of white supremacy and because of his role in the Klan. And it was only, you know, in the past couple of years that they've decided to rename the building. And part of it, part of the justification for renaming it was, you know, students are interacting with the building. You know, you actually have to go into the building to have class. You know, you can walk around the Confederate monument or not look at the Confederate monument on campus. There's a big Confederate soldier monument on campus. But if you're assigned class in Sanders Hall, you actually have to physically enter it and are in some ways reinscribing that name with power by...
Well, and buildings take on different meanings by their use.
Sure.
So yeah. Again, although Monticello was at one time a plantation, it's now a museum where among the things that can be discussed and examined and critiqued is slavery. And university buildings in particular, the principles of a university and the purpose of a university is to educate. Yeah, and so buildings take on another role. In fact, in our very first episode or second episode, I think we talked about the relationship between universities and slavery, and this is kind of an offshoot of that, I guess. But I think you're right, buildings do have another purpose. Interestingly, in terms of the international dimension, it's not, I mean, this has been an ongoing debate here, that is in the UK and elsewhere. There was the Rhodes Must Fall movement a few years ago, which started at the University of Cape Town, I believe it was, and the University of Cape Town took down a statue of Cecil Rhodes, which made sense, especially in the South African context, where I guess that goes to your view about local sensibilities. And Rhodes is seen, Rhodes, who was a major figure in the British Empire at the turn of the last century, was seen as a kind of archetypal symbol and of white supremacy and British imperialism. Interestingly, that movement spread from South Africa, and there was an argument that the campus should be decolonized, as they put it, to Oxford, where there are Rhodes scholars, and Rhodes is a major figure in Oxford in all kinds of ways, and a historic figure. There's a statue of Rhodes at Oxford, and there was a great deal of debate last year about whether that statue should be taken down. And interestingly, although the there was a kind of non-binding vote, I think, among at the student in a student debating society saying that it should come down, but when donors objected, particularly alumni donors, the statue was retained and a plaque was added to it. And so this is an ongoing debate here. I think you're right. There is a difference between statues and buildings. And there's a difference between and where statues are located is important. Because I take your point about battlefields. So to move us away from the South deliberately, I mean, if you go to Little Bighorn Battlefield, there's a long-standing monument there to the U.S. soldiers, the federal soldiers who were killed at the Battle of Little Bighorn, and that remains there in Montana. But more recently, there's been a monument added to the Lakota warriors who were killed at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And so there's balance there, if you will, although one can argue that the monument to the federal soldiers killed, again, on native land is as offensive as putting a monument to Confederate soldiers in a predominantly African American community.
Well, but on the other, you know, I think the Little Bighorn's an interesting example. I mean, with battlefields, though, in the Civil War, for the most part, you go to a battlefield with the intention of going to a battlefield,
and you know what you're
more or less know what you're in for. Whereas if you're putting it next to a courthouse, your ability to not interact with the courthouse may be predicated.
Right, I take your point that the courthouse is a symbol of state power. It means that statue is.
Yeah, and, if you could, and I think those listeners here in the South know that every stupid small town in the South has a courthouse, and right next to the courthouse, there's almost always a Confederate statue. And I think the relationship between those buildings isn't accidental. You know, in some ways, the debate over Rhodes in some ways mirrors the debate over Calhoun. You know, with Calhoun College at Yale, there was a long-standing debate about whether or not to rename that. It was only within the past year they eventually decided to rename that. You know, and Calhoun's a very complicated figure because, he's...
Explain who he is, David.
Oh, okay, the cliff over. John C. Calhoun was the longtime senator from South Carolina and also vice president. He was one of the leading proponents of Southern nationalism in the sort of decades prior to the Civil War. He dies, I think, in 1850 or 1851. I want to say 1850. But he long time sort of spoke as a voice for slavery as a positive good. And so, you know, he is commemorated in lots of ways. There's an enormous statue of him, for instance, in Charleston, South Carolina. He's up on a big column, you know, as they do sometimes. And what is being commemorated in that statue is could be lots of things, potentially. You can see in that statue what you want to see in the statue. If you want to see that statue as a symbol of white supremacy, you can do that. If you want to do that as a symbol to somebody who was politically important in that state for a very long period of time, you can see that as well. But the fact that the statue is still up in South Carolina and the college at Yale has been renamed, I think, is indicative of both the ways in which physical spaces, you know, buildings are different than statues, and the ways in which local conditions, you know, shape all these things.
How does a college in New Haven, Connecticut end up being named after John C. Calhoun, the kind of South Carolina author of secession argument?
Yeah, which, and he didn't go there. I don't know what the origin was. That's a good question. We should probably check up. But I remember when they were having debates about, you know, renaming it over the years, there were lots of people who were sort of graduates of that college at Yale who said, look, you know, I was a graduate of Calhoun College, and Calhoun College means something to me, independent of John C. Calhoun.
So we're back to the fact that buildings take on new purposes.
You know, the name, you know, has additional meanings to them as a consequence of that, so...
So David, I mean, we need to wrap this up, but and I'll answer this as well. But let me put you a simple question to you: should Confederate monuments come down?
Oh, jeez. I think we need to have. I'm equivocating because I think it's complicated. One of the things I think that's happened is really since the shooting. You know, in Charleston in June of 2015, that when Dylann Roof went into the African American church and shot people during a Bible study class, there really has been this sort of debate that's been going on for a long time about the place of Confederate monuments in the South. That sort of simmering debate, I think, has gone up to a boil, right? I think in the immediate aftermath of that, the easy symbols to take down have been taken down. So the Confederate flag has come down in lots of places.
Not privately flown, but when flown by the state.
Or, you know, so they used to have like lots of state license plate where you can get the novelty license. But so lots of states stopped doing that. You know, lots of businesses that were selling things with the Confederate flag on it stopped. So Walmart stopped selling things with the Confederate flag on it, and Amazon stopped selling things with the Confederate flag on it. So, you know, that was easy in some ways to get rid of flags, or at least, you know, flags as agents of the state, or flags as being commercial products, has largely declined, but I think precipitously. The fact the United States responds to a mass shooting by taking down flags and not by implementing gun control.
Yes. If Walmart stopped selling guns instead of Confederate flags,
that's
a topic for another week.
America. Anyway, you know, this flag, I think, though, is an easy symbol to take down, in part because you have to erect a flag every day. You have to put it up, and it's so that you have to sort of constantly.
It's also not permanent. You can take it down when you can. Theoretically, put it back up,
right? You know, monuments, I think, are more complicated. And I think we need to have these discussions about sort of, okay, what did this mean when the monument was put up? Because I think that matters. I think looking not only at sort of what physical monument is, but look at what the people who were putting up the monument were trying to say with the monument. You know, look at the dedication ceremony, look at the newspaper coverage, look at these things, because I think that will tell us a lot more about what these monuments mean or what it meant 100 years ago when they were erected. And I think if, you know, we're no longer comfortable having them in the public square, I think we should take them down. I mean, just in the same way that other things in the public square that we no longer find tasteful because they're artistically out of sync with modern values or whatever it is. I think we, you know, the permanence of anything is a bit of a folly. Everything's gonna crumble eventually, says Ozymandias. And we need to have those debates. And I think taking it on a case by case basis is probably the best way to do that, rather than simply tearing them all down or leaving them all up. And I think there's a place to put these, a lot of these monuments in museums. I think where you can, we can contextualize them properly and you know, document what they say, not only about sort of the Civil War era, but what also they say about, you know, the Gilded Age, and think about, you know, the New South and all the things that are going on when these monuments were erected. I think that's the place for most of them.
I think I broadly agree with you. I think that I think context is important. I think I like the distinction you made between the town square, as it were, and battlefields. Mm-hmm. I think maybe where there existed battlefields, you leave them there. I think the ones in town squares, I think if it's a monument explicitly to white supremacy, like the one that came down earlier this week, I think those do need to go, and the museum's the right place. I think there may be a kind of category in the middle where we want to provide more context in terms of, you had a plaque to it, explaining when it was put up and who put it up, that sort of thing. Kind of what Oxford did with the Rhodes statue, but not necessarily in response to alumni outrage. But I think you're right. We need a little bit of nuance, and this is a topic that doesn't tend to lend itself to nuance.
Well, I think it's partially because people are sort of emotionally attached. You know, there's the intellectual response to these, and there's the emotional response to this. And you know, some people say, well, you know, lots of academics are like, oh, we'll put up a plaque next to the big monument to contextualize it. And New Orleans actually did that at one point. I think in the 80s they put up a plaque saying this monument doesn't respect our values anymore. Which is kind of odd to say, like, here's this big 30-foot statue, and we're distancing ourselves from it, saying it doesn't respect who we are. That's the disjuncture there is I think, a bit odd. You know, we could put up more statues and put up a, you know, 30-foot tall statue of a freed African American next to the statue.
Well, actually, I mean, we don't want to prolong. We do have to wrap this up. But Monument Avenue in Richmond is very interesting in that regard. It's a grand boulevard, which built around a series of monuments to Confederate generals. It's beautiful in many respects, although... Anyway, but they added in the recent past a statue of Arthur Ashe at the, you know, to the, which itself was controversial. I'm not sure it quite works that way, though. But anyway, I think we've probably, this has been a monumental podcast, so I don't think we need to go any further with that. But I think we're in broad agreement. I think some nuance is necessary. And I think location does. It's location, as the real estate agents tell us. So, all right. David, last drops.
All right. Well, I'm going to endorse another podcast. Not that you should stop listening to this podcast and listen to a different podcast.
You probably stopped 20 minutes ago.
For those of you who are still listening, continue listening. But I want to endorse another podcast, which I'm betting actually many of you already listened to. And that's Liz Covert's Ben Franklin's World, which is I guess she's been podcasting now for 3 or 4 years. She's got 130 episodes, and it's a podcast about early American history, about, you know, more often than not, they're interviewing, you know, early American historians about their work. And she's had some really important names on in the past, but what I want to particularly recommend is her most recent episode. Frank, have you heard about this one? In which they are interviewing this Jefferson scholar about his work. And in fact, if you want another hour of Frank this week on your iTunes, this is the way to get it, because Frank's on the most recent episode of Ben Franklin's World, talking to Liz about, especially about Jefferson's ideas about empires of liberty. So go listen to Ben Franklin's World once you stop listening to us. It's a good podcast. Frank, what you got?
Oh, shucks, David, I'm blushing. Although Liz's podcast is great, even if this week is a bit of a downer. if you don't want to go listen to that podcast, I've got some TV. I've got a TV recommendation for you. I'm going to give people the impression that all I do is watch TV. But anyway.
You also go to movies.
I do. There's a good series on Netflix called Nobel. It's a Norwegian series. And it's a kind of political drama and an international spy thing. Well, not spies, really. It's an international drama as well. And it's a drama that revolves around a series of incidents involving Norwegian troops serving in Afghanistan, and then the repercussions back in Afghanistan. And there's a plot about the Nobel Peace Prize. David did ask me before we started what it has to do with America. There's a slight subplot, as opposed to Frank's TV time. This needs to in some way to relate to the United States. There's a subplot there involving the U.S. Defense Secretary. The very first scene of the first episode, which is, I won't spoil it, it's very dramatic, and it turns on this decision that the soldiers, the Norwegian soldiers in Afghanistan have to make about whether to shoot somebody who's suspected of carrying a bomb. And one of them says to the other, you know, if we were Americans, we would have killed him already. Because they're worried about whether they're making the right decision or not. And they have a great deal of trepidation about killing a civilian. So there's a little bit of tension within the NATO in the program, I suppose. It's a very interesting program. It's very, very well made. It's very, very well written. It's on Netflix. It's called Nobel, and I can recommend it to you. Its relationship to the United States is really minimal, but you know, not everything's about America.
It's got the subtitles, so it requires some, you know, active watching in order to participate.
Yes, but our listeners are very literate.
Oh, so to
I'm
be sure.
I'm sure they can read subtitles. Or we're huge in Norway. I'm
exactly. Norwegian listeners, if you are listening to this in Norway, let us know. We want to get in contact with an international audience. All right, so if you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at Whiskey Rebel Pod. You can also like us on Facebook, leave a review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. We're going to do our book draw probably over the weekend. So our lucky winners, if you're listening now, this is your last chance. We've got a couple of days. We're going to do it on the first. Lucky winners get a book, both by Frank and me, or one, two listeners, I guess. Great. Till next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David.